Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's start in with our introductions. The first thing I'd like to offer to folks who are on the outer ring, including our friends from GW, please come to the table. The ethic here at CSIS generally and specifically today is inclusive, and we don't have backbenchers unless we absolutely have to and there's no room at the table. So whether you're dressed in a tie or not, or dressed down, whatever, please do fill in the chairs up front and do contribute to the discussion as you feel comfortable. I think they probably teach you in life there are no free lunches, and you see today that that's a lie. Another thing your elders tell you that is not true. In Washington, there are many free lunches, but please do join and contribute to the discussion. This is East Asia Strategy Group. We do this regularly, I like to say. We used to do it every month. This year has been particularly hectic and difficult, so this is actually, the first East Asia Strategy Group we've done this year. We have several versions of this we're going to do in the next several weeks. They're normally breakfast meetings and off the record. This one is at lunch and on the record, certainly. There's nothing that I think is a sensitive topic to some degree, but nothing clearly that we need to be watching our words about or that we shouldn't be discussing very openly. So this is indeed a topic that is as current as today's news. And all of you know it's a very busy week generally here in Washington, given the visit of Hu Jintao. And there was some suggestion that perhaps Japan would be on the agenda. It seems that it was not. But yet you pick up the morning paper and you see much about Japan and Korea going at it once again. It just underscores the issue that history is not just history. The historical is not the past. It is present very much in the relationships of Northeast Asia, and that the sociological factors in each of these countries, Japan, China, and Korea, the fact that we're having an increasingly proud, self-confident, nationalistic or patriotic or proud nations is creating an interesting dynamic. And I'm part of the International Security Program here at CSIS. You wouldn't normally think of this as a security matter, but it is very much a security matter. It's very much a strategic issue for the United States and its relationships in Northeast Asia, whether it's our allies, Japan and Korea, who are going at it, or our increasing engagement of China. So I was very, very happy when my friends at George Washington University asked if we could host this event. I think it's an honor for us to do so, and I'm very much looking forward to the comments and commentary of our panelists here at the podium. You have the list of people. You have their bios. I won't go into great depth there. But with that, let me turn to my friend and colleague Mike Mochizuki to make some opening comments as well.
Thank you very much, Derek. I'd like to thank Derek and the CSIS East Asia Strategy Group for graciously agreeing to co-sponsor this event and hosting this event and providing us all with a free lunch. We certainly appreciate this. This is a really a joint program, and at GW, Dachin Yang and I co-direct a research and policy program at the Seeger Center for Asian Studies under the title Memory and Reconciliation in the Asia-Pacific region. And this is a program as part of that larger initiative. What I'd like to do is just to kick off the panel by providing just one possible frame of reference in which to evaluate and analyze this effort among the scholars and historians of the three countries that have produced this this three-country history book. And then I'll turn it over to our three panelists. And I've got six quick points to make. First, I agree completely with Derek that the history issue really is also a security issue. I don't believe that history is the driver necessarily of the security challenges that we face in East Asia. I still think probably material interests are still primary, like changes in the distribution of power in the region, military modernization programs, territorial disputes, energy needs, and technological competition. But history can indeed exacerbate security conflicts and tensions, exacerbate what political scientists call security dilemmas, and they can impede and make much more difficult efforts by states to manage security tensions and conflicts over material interests. And so as someone that studies security policy, I naturally came to take a keen interest in the history question. Secondly, there's been a lot of attention over the last year or so on the Yasukuni Shrine problem, and some have called for Japanese restraints or even cessation of the Prime Minister visiting the Yasukuni Shrine. But I, for one, feel that even if that were to happen, that would not resolve the historical issue. In fact, all it does is provides a gateway for a possible dialogue on the history issue. So even if the Yasukuni Shrine visits stop, there is still a long ways to go before we can achieve any sense of deep reconciliation regarding the history issue. But I do recognize that the Yasukuni issue may be an impediment for that kind of dialogue. The third point I would like to make is that the current practice of national approval of various history textbooks has tended to exacerbate the tensions across countries regarding historical memory and perhaps impedes the process of reconciliation. Because every time we have the announcement of the approval of textbooks and a revelation of the changes that were made, it tends to provoke nationalistic responses on all sides. Since the 1980s, I would say that this whole textbook approval issue has no longer become just an issue within a country, but it has become an internationalized issue. The fourth point I would make is that a quasi-official bilateral or even trilateral dialogue about history may be one way of overcoming this sort of conflict about history. And we all know that there has been a quasi-official dialogue between Japan and the Republic of Korea. And although I am very much supportive of such quasi-official dialogues, and I think Bob Zelick was essentially right in proposing a China-Japan-U.S. history dialogue, it also raises a number of problems, because when you have a quasi-official dialogue, then the problem of what historians will be participants in such a dialogue in each country become problematic, because there are certainly different points of view in these countries about history. And the country that I know best, Japan, there is indeed a vigorous debate about history. Also, when you have these kinds of quasi-official dialogues, I think there is an initial incentive to somehow define or accentuate the differences across countries about history. And in some sense, it may make more difficult trying to achieve a common understanding. And then this gets to my fifth point and the subject for the panel today, that given some of the downsides to a quasi-official history dialogue, there may be a real positive role that non-government-initiated or sanctioned historical dialogues can play in trying to move forward the process towards a common understanding about history. And the project that we will be talking about in the panel today is perhaps the most significant and the first celebrated effort in this vein, and hopefully it will spur follow-on initiatives and other efforts like this. But I would have to make one caveat. Looking at the Japanese participants in this project, they tend to be primarily from the progressive side of the debate on the Japanese side. I mean, one of the most prominent members of the Japan group is the famous historian of the Nanjing Massacre, Kasahara Tokushi. Another person is the Secretary General of the Children and Textbooks Japan Network 21, which has provided the countervailing voice to the Tsukudokai, the controversial Tsukudokai textbook. And so although we will assess the achievements of this group, a dialogue between essentially progressive historians in Japan and the Chinese and Korean historians may be much easier than a dialogue that might include more conservative Japanese historians. And then finally, I would like to end with a point about the role of the United States. Deputy Secretary of State Bob Zelek raised the issue of possible American participation in such a historical dialogue. You know, of course, I think we all agree that the United States has keen security and foreign policy interests at stake in the history question in Asia, but it's still probably is debatable whether or not the United States should play a role in a history dialogue among East Asians. And there are some East Asian leaders who feel that America does not have such a role. But my personal feeling is that although I see the primacy of a dialogue among East Asians as the key, that at some point, and even perhaps at a very early point, American historians, journalists, analysts, and citizens need to get involved in this dialogue. Because I believe America is by no means an innocent bystander in the tragic and horrific developments of the region. And the United States played a role, I think, in not facilitating, if not impeding, a serious effort at historical reconciliation in East Asia. And so now I'd like to turn the program to our three panelists. First, Professor Jordan Sand of Georgetown University will speak from a Japan perspective. Professor Soon-Won Park of Howard University will then look at the Korean perspective. And then my colleague at GW, Professor Dachin Yang, will cover the China perspective. So, Jordan?
Would you keep an eye on the clock for me? I don't know how. Hi, is that on?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Thanks very much. I want to thank Professor Yang Daqing for including me in this discussion today. I should say that I'm not an expert on textbooks, and I'm not really either an expert on the history of Japanese imperialism, although since I'm a modern Japanese historian, I can hardly avoid it, and it's an important part of what goes on in my classroom. This is significant to me, but it's not exactly my turf. Nevertheless, we're talking about teaching the history of East Asia, and that's something that I do. So Yang Daqing sent us a series of questions to consider, and it helped kind of outline what we should be talking about. I'm going to just follow his questions. Some of them I was unable to answer. He first wanted a bit of practical information about how this thing came into being and who the Japanese editors are. Mike Mochizuki pointed out to us that this is from the progressive side of the Japanese historical establishment. But let me give you what they say of themselves from the inside back cover of the Japanese publication. In spring of 2001, the textbook of the Council for New Japanese History Textbooks, this is the right-wing revisionist group, also known in Japanese as the Tsukudokai, appeared. And powerful opposition movements were awakened in Japan, China, and Korea. And in response, the first Forum on Peace and Historical Consciousness in East Asia, involving scholars, teachers, and ordinary citizens from the three countries, was held in Nanjing in March 2002. And this forum then met a total of 10 times and finally bore fruit in the form of this book, or I should say these books, right, these three texts. And the Japanese government had no involvement in this process. Of 13 names on the book lists of Japanese participants, seven have Japanese university affiliations. The rest teach secondary school or are involved in organizations related to education, like the one that Mike Mochizuki just mentioned. And as one would expect, since this is a response within the Japanese context, this is a response to the Tsukudokai, to the revisionists. They're clearly activists against both the conservative Japanese government version of history and that of the new revisionists. I'm aware of one earlier attempt that looks rather similar. I gather just from this handout that we could include this among many at an international textbook collaboration of this kind for East Asia, and that's binational between Japan and Korea, a joint study effort that began in 1989, and this was following on the first wave of diplomatic disputes over history textbooks that began in 1982. And this group never made it as far as joint publication. At least they had not as of 2000, when a rather depressing report on the subject from one of the Japanese participants appeared in Laura Hine and Mark Selden's excellent essay collection called Censoring History, which I recommend to you for looking comprehensively at these issues. Yang Daqing asked about the reception of the three-country textbook and whether it was being used in schools. And this turns out to be kind of a complicated question because it's not a textbook. It's a supplementary text. I was able to find, poking around on the web, that an organization called the Japanese Congress of Journalists gave it an award in 2005, and that upwards of 70,000 copies had sold by late 2005. It occupied the number 10 spot on the bestseller list at Junkudo, which is sort of a Borders Books. So it was doing well in the general market. But school textbook books, as I'm sure you know, are privately published and then vetted in this meticulous process by the Japanese Ministry of Education, which censors and recommends new phrases and so on, but does not author textbooks. It nevertheless creates a remarkable uniformity, at least in format and in the sort of formulae through which history is presented, and the textbooks tend to be short. And this one was not even up for consideration. They were not proposing it. They were proposing instead teachers would use it to supplement these short textbooks, which we should never imagine are all that the students see of history in their classrooms. In any case, if it had gone up before the board, I think there's no question it would not have passed. In this sense, it's really quite like the textbook of Ienaga Saburo, published in English as The Pacific War, something a lot of us use in college classrooms here to give you a give American students a Japanese critical voice on the war. And Ienaga, as you probably know, fought in the courts for almost three decades to contest the constitutionality of the textbook review system, and his own textbook was never permitted into the Japanese classrooms. So he's also just part of what I think we should recognize as an enormous and diverse academic discourse in Japan that is critical of Japanese imperialism and wartime atrocities, and alongside those books put out by the Tsukurukai at the Borders Books equivalents in Japan are stacks of the Nanjing Massacre and so forth scholarship done by Japanese scholars. Naturally, the revisionists and their primary media organ, the Sankei newspaper, have been outspoken in their criticism of it. I saw online an interesting left-wing Japanese blog that praised the book but criticized it for whitewashing the Chinese and Korean post-war histories, post-World War II histories. Others have also noted the focus of the book is really the Japanese invasion and the war, and have suggested that that should have been made explicit rather than claiming, as the introduction does, that this is a comprehensive modern history. And I agree with that assessment. Some sections of this book show signs of an awkward union of three national histories rather than a true transnational history. For example, the treatment of Taiwan. The Taiwanese get colonized in 1895, and the book gives them their moment in history as resistors to that colonization. But then Taiwan doesn't get to have any more history after that. And we can imagine what's involved in that, the interest in avoiding dealing with a Taiwanese colonial history as well as a Taiwanese post-colonial history. The issue of the program, the Japanese program called Kominka, the making of imperial subjects that was begun in 1937 to mobilize the colonial populations for the war effort, gets quite substantial treatment, but the treatment is only about the coercive aspects of Kominka and makes no mention of the tens of thousands of Koreans and Taiwanese who volunteered when they were allowed through this program to participate in the Japanese Imperial Army. I think it's more effective, for example, in its treatment of comfort women, which seemed to me both transnational and careful and mapped, which I was impressed with, and also things like repatriation after the war, something that often gets overlooked, nicely treated here, right down to what happened to populations of Koreans and Japanese left on the island of Sakhalin. One thing that intellectuals from these countries easily shared, and this was probably a pretty, conflict-ridden process that they went through, even if the Japanese participants were well on the left within Japan. One thing that these intellectuals could readily share, that's opposition to the U.S. And I thought at first this would be an anti-American history, but I think it's not. It's a history almost evacuated of America, which appears very briefly, it's true. But for example, in the summary of Section 3, which is the section dealing with World War II, we get no mention of the U.S. Instead, quote, "the peoples of the countries of Asia that were invaded and ruled by Japan fought and defeated Japanese imperialism, becoming an important wing of the global war against fascism." Let's think about the historical significance of this. I'd like to make one comment about the context that Tsukurukai as the adversary here and the significance of this. School textbooks are a natural thing for us to focus our attention on, and it's natural that international disputes revolve around them because they're presenting some kind of officially sanctioned history, and we imagine this is what the country has decided to pass on to the next generation. But we should not delude ourselves that this is primarily where young people are learning about history now. As we know, in media-saturated society, it's through television. In Japan especially, it is through comics. And I gather there was an earlier meeting, was that at the Wilson Center or here, about new nationalism, and people have probably looked at the work of Kobayashi Yoshinori together, the Japanese comic artist who is probably the most powerful political voice in Japan today, if you want to ask me, just sort of through media influence. Anyway, he's a member of this revisionist group, the right-wing revisionists, who call themselves, by the way, or their approach, liberalist history. They call it that because they're claiming to be writing a Japanese history free of the ideologies of the Cold War. It was a history for the nation, an independent history. And it's an unapologetic neo-nationalism. I think this is a very different nationalism we're dealing with than of an earlier generation when, for example, the textbook incidents were over euphemism. They were over advancement rather than invasion. Now we have, not in the textbooks, but in the comic books and in the mass media, we have an openly triumphalist nationalism. Their textbook, the one that was passed, is, compared to the things that they say outside of the classroom, pretty tame stuff. Still full of problems, but pretty tame stuff. Kobayashi is intentionally provocative, angry, and has a complete agenda. The other thing I want to note about this new nationalism's difference is I think it's a very American kind of nationalism. It's American in its influences and American in its style. And, for example, one of the other key founders of the Tsukurukai, Fujioka Nobukatsu, was here in Washington at the time of the Gulf War. And at that time, he was on the Japanese left. And the Gulf War caused him to flip-flop. And what he saw was all this criticism of Japanese checkbook diplomacy. And he thought, the Cold War has determined left and right in Japan all these years, and I stood for neutrality in the Cold War. That was the left position, right? And now that's over, and we're still stuck being sort of bullied around by the U.S. This was the perception. And it determined him that we have to have a powerful military of our own. We ought to be independent. This is something that on which these people agree with many people here in Washington. And that, therefore, also we should be unashamed of our military past. After all, every country writes a history that their youth can be proud of. I say it's also American in style because, if I may just show you four slides from Kobayashi's comics. Excuse me. Let's see. American in style because of this sort of brash, in-your-face, unabashedly jingoistic sort of talk makes me think of American talk radio and sections of the blogosphere. And its populist claim, I mean a little more significantly, that what his claim is that he's standing up against hypocritical politicians and the intellectual elite, and he's speaking common sense, he's speaking truth to power kind of thing. That's a classic American move. And in this kind of cartooning, this is from his diatribe about Yasukuni Shrine. The China and the U.S. are bullies, and Japanese politicians are constantly kowtowing and they're mealy-mouthed, as you see here. There's even a kind of American multiculturalism to it. The Americans have theirs, we have ours. Here, for example, comparing Arlington National Cemetery to Yasukuni Shrine. And I should note, this is another difference, that to the old right, the uniqueness of the Japanese imperial line was crucial, right? And it's not a big deal for the it's not absent, but it's a minor concern of a political nature for the new right. The issue is that Japan is normal, it ought to be normal, and that things it did in the past were no different from the things that that the Western powers had done, and it's time for Japanese to have a proud history. Here's a bit of that multiculturalism. In the West, they have Christianity, we have Shinto, and it's only natural that our ways of remembering the dead would be different. So just to conclude, I think that in light of this, in a sense, the textbook issue as it appeared in the 1980s has been left long behind. Not that textbooks and what goes on in the classroom don't matter, but just the kind of language we're now seeing in the popular media and its enormous impact on young people, which I see in my classroom too, really has shifted the ground profoundly. And so in that sense, I'd say that process is probably more important than product in looking at this textbook initiative. A universal history in the schools may be still a long way off, but if you ask how U.S. Historians can contribute, I think, in fact, it would be a pretty sobering exercise, even for the most liberal and international-minded, were U.S. historians to participate in something similar, a kind of Pacific history co-authored with Japanese, Chinese, Korean, and, say, Vietnamese and Philippine historians. It would be as much of a trial and perhaps as useful as a learning process as it seems to have been for these Japanese progressives. I'll close there.
I thank Dachin to invite me and be part of this panel. My specialty was colonial history and Imperial Japan. And recent 2 or 3 years, I've been following this forced labor issue, first from compensation and reparation perspective, but getting into this one. And I'll present some Korean perspective on this very important product. Process is important, but first we have to have product too. This is a breakthrough. I've been watching this whole history redress affairs, and this is a real breakthrough. Dear fruit of all these scholarly and history NGO movement of three countries. I don't have enough time, so I'll try to focus on three questions in my talk. First, how it came about in Korean domestic context, and secondly, contents of the book, especially comparing to the existing Korean history textbooks. And thirdly, how it's received. It's still too early to have a fuller and nuanced evaluation, but I'll have some update on how it's received in Korean context. First section is somewhat repetitious with Jordan's, but as he mentioned, the second history textbook controversy in spring of 2001 because of this Hu Shousha new textbook was accepted as one of the screenable government history textbooks. to talk about countermeasures. There were two levels, government level, there were Koizumi visiting Seoul and talk, and then in the civil society level, scholars and civic activists gathered together. In March 2002, 100 scholars gathered in Nanjing, and within 2 months, they organized a special committee to develop Korea-Japan-China joint history guidebook. This here, please pay attention, this is a supplementary guidebook they first tried, and the product is this one in all three languages, published in three countries, and the English translation is going on, which is a very important step to penetrate into this U.S. public and let them know. Ignorance is a basic problem here. Let them know in detail, and the University of Hawaii is doing it now. So after that, 3 years, 11 times of meeting, discussions, debates, and drafting and publication. And within 3 years, May of 2005, last year, this came out. They talked about mainly the purpose of the book, and they made it clear in the introduction here too. Instead of nationalistic, individual countries' nationalistic perspective, they take up peace, human rights, and democratic historical perspective as their ultimate goal for narratives. And subjects was certainly modern and contemporary history, and they had to talk about first each country's textbook framework, how to revise that and make it into one East Asian reconciled view on their modern and contemporary experience. That was a really challenge, and they made through, it seems like. It's not complete. It's still a history guidebook, not the history textbook, but certainly a breakthrough. It's very awkward, this just a juxtaposition of the three countries together instead of, you know, inner structural interpretation and narratives, but still it was quite an accomplishment. 6 chapters and then 21 subchapters they finally decided, and from April 2004 on they started drafting, and within a year taking, you know, drafting and selection of photos and charts and tables all done. In May of 2005, it came out. And from Korean side, the authors and participants are basically non-governmental scholars, history professors, and history teachers. This is very important. High school history teachers, that's where process is going on, how it's taught based upon this product. So they were a very active part of it. And then here I want to introduce one history NGO. Korea is undergoing real, almost overheated, internet media all involved, overheated history redress problem or movement, both internal and external history redress movement. And so wide spectrum, very nationalistic, conservative to radical progressives. And one history NGO, around 60 and history NGOs are actively moving these days in South Korea. And one successful, most progressive history NGO is a group called APHEN, A-P-H-E-N, Asia Peace and History Education Network, which was deeply involved with this this project, Mireul Yeoksa. And co-chairman was the Seo Jung-seok, leading historian, and one woman named Yang Mi-gang. She became a queen of this history NGO movement in South Korea and played a real good leadership role, bringing the private donation and getting this progressive paper like Hangyore Shimbun get into the project. So it's very non-governmental and the transnational history NGO movement. Quite a successful example of it. And as the authors, some of you know some Korean context. So Seo Jung-seok from Sungkyunkwan University, Shinju Baek from SNU, Kim Sung Bo, Wang Hyun-jong from Yonsei, and then Moon Ju-young, Park Chung-hyun, Lee In-seok, and Yang Mi-gang, history teachers and also history NGO leaders. Now, the contents of it, I did some comparison with the existing Korean history textbook. Because Korean history textbooks improved a lot throughout this democratizing movement in the 1990s. So as of early 2006, there existed one state-written middle school history textbook and six high school-level government-screened history textbooks. So those six, I went over and then picked up them, supposed to be most widely used and the most liberal one, which is Kumsong Publishing Company's Hanguk Geunhyeondaesa, which is an exclusive history high school-level history textbook on modern and contemporary history, which is quite an improvement from even early 1990s. Guess that's going on very actively in South Korean academia and also this history, public history education field. I examined four books with my specialty, the forced labor issue. And in a little broader sense, 1930 to 1945, wartime, how it's depicted in Korean history textbooks and also this Mirae-ryul Yeoneun Yeoksa. So I focused on each book's handling of the statistics, facts, descriptions of the forced labor issue, as well as comfort women and the pro-Japanese collaborative issue in relation to the 30 to 45 wartime period. Certainly there was a clear gap between middle school textbook, which is one state-written one, and all these high school textbooks, especially the Kumsong publishers, Hanguk Geunhyeondaesa one. It was quite interesting, very much enriched with the photos and all these. And these 1990s Korean colonial historiography also made some leap toward this much more diverse, objective, and balanced researches and also evaluation sense. So it was quite well reflected in this Hanguk Geunhyeondaesa history book. And statistically, they were quite sophisticated in honestly admitting that even the statistics is in controversy. We can't have a clear-cut number yet, both forced labor and the comfort women issue, all these, which I was quite surprised. But other textbooks, as an overall evaluation, they remain this victim image-oriented, basic nationalistic framework. So over this 1930 to 1945, descriptions follow the common framework of the Naisen Itai policy, Gominka policies, wartime mobilization and exploitation of material and human resources, including soldiers, forced laborers, comfort women, and wartime pro-Japanese collaborative activities. So no textbook came up with the Koreans' own response, resistance, and the socio-economic structural impact of the wartime experiences. But don't get the wrong idea. This is a textbook cases. I've been following colonial historiography of South Korea in the 90s. There have been really breakthrough and so much counter-narratives to overcome. Admitting nationalist historiography, they contributed a lot in the earlier period, but they want to overcome and surpass that and then go into much more diverse and enriched picture of a colonial society using this new concept of colonial modernity. Because society got much more complex in the 20s and 30s. So class, gender issue, and the state and society relationship, all these become very complex, which cannot be depicted with just one nationalist historical perspective. So that's all done, but the problem is it was not reflected fully in the textbook cases. And in that sense, that Kumsung Publishing Company's volume was quite impressive. They have come a long way. And compared to that, this Mirae-ul Yeonhun Yeoksa, again, I saw first the labor issue and that period of 1930 to 45. So I have 6 points here to but again, I have to emphasize that it's still supplementary guidebook, not the history textbook. So the reception is in the very indirect process that they had to go through. And, of course, after this volume, the same transnational that history group is aiming at next 5 years, the second project, which they hope they can come out with, not supplementary guidebook, but the real historical narrative. Not the textbook, probably, but full historical narrative. So the evaluation point of this Mirae-ul Yeonhun Yeoksa in Korean, or history to open for the future. First, many page. I was quite impressed that many pages spent on the World War II in Asia itself, which is quite lacking in Korean history textbook. To stress on these exploitation and victimization of Koreans, they lost the whole broad picture of how World War II progressed and ended. So for the full broader East Asian understanding, this was quite important from my judgment. Even with the detailed map of war, so that readership can understand World War II rather than victimized portrait of the period. Both China and Japan, Korea, same way here. Covering all three countries' wartime experiences. And their limit was that it was juxtaposed, like a display of three countries. They talked about this, and there was some strong opposition from Chinese members. I read the background stories, anecdotal stories, and they came out that writing East Asian history from Japanese imperial point of view, they really refused to accept again. So they came up with this compromise. Three countries' experiences in the display, kind of. It's awkward in that sense. It's not, there's no inner structural analysis on the whole East Asian World War II. Secondly, as for the statistics of the forced labor, this volume used 8 million in total and around 870,000 as Koreans who went overseas, which seemed sometime exaggerated, sometime underestimated, and unverified, most of all. The issue of statistics of this period itself is still controversial and divided by the scholars. And this is very important as a historian. Statistics is so easy to persuade and manipulate the whole image. Like a media's survey and tolls, often it can be counterproductive and misguiding from the real issue. So this is, for me, very important angle, and I think Mirae-ul Yeonhun Yeoksa has some limit in that sense, just adopting. And the Comfort Woman's case, between 80,000 to 150,000, and that's still controversial. We just don't have real written evidence for that. It's just a calculation based upon the size of the soldiers and all this. Then third, it had extended coverage on the Comfort Women issue, even carrying a detailed full-page map of the comfort stations in Asia. So again, this is in proportion probably because of some feminist scholars involved here. It's overstressed, imbalance from my viewpoint. It also introduced collaborator groups in colonial Korea and occupied China. In Korean, they are called Chinilpa, and in China, it's called Hanchen or Han Chen in Chinese pronunciation. But this is juxtaposed with the activities in Japan who are anti-war activists. So it's quite new approach of this World War II experience as a people, anti-state and anti-war. Also for forced labor issue, testimony of Japanese soldiers on comfort women recruit and comfort women contact, and also forced labor recruitment and all these were included, which is quite new and strong point of this medallion in Yoksa. And the fifth point was the newness on wartime experience in this volume was an inclusion of both victimization and aggression of Japanese people in parallel with the sufferings of Korean and Chinese people. Again, this was a hot issue in the top debates I heard. Chinese were really against it, and Korean took side of Japanese, that Japanese people's suffering should be included. So Chinese were quite miffed at Koreans' kind of real heated debates were going on and finally came out. It was a good thing from my evaluation. And the sixth point, which is very important, is the value of Chapter 4 and 5, which handles this, which is mainly aimed at the adult readership. They handle the post-1945 handling of this World War II and also injustices and atrocities and also suffering of the people, how it's handled. So Tokyo Tribunal in 46, and then 1951, San Francisco Treaty dealing of that issue, which omitted Korea and Taiwan completely because they were just colonies, not the World War II enemies. And then 1965, Japan-Korea Normalization Treaty, in 1972, China and Japan Normalization Treaty, and how these World War II issue and memory and reconciliation issue were handled, all in Chapter 4 and 5. I think this is the real value of this volume. It's toward the public history education and adult readership, including U.S. Adult readership. Even for me, it was a fascinating description of it, very balanced and the nuanced interpretation of the whole issue and also three countries' diverse attitude. You can learn a lot in this 4 and 5. So that's the I really appreciate this volume in that sense. Now, the last point, reception of the book. So I emailed this APEN leader, and she sent these quick answers. How many copies sold? 55,000 copies, which is not bad, within a year. This is a very positive number. And the school teachers used this and mentioned in the class and adopted some viewpoints. And the media scholars and researchers appreciate and encourage rather than criticize. Very well received, except a strong reaction from the Japanese writers. This she mentioned, this is Japan side. But students themselves, probably high school level, perceive it as a somewhat difficult historical narrative. I think because of Chapter 4 and 5, which is probably too adult, too broad, and the current political issues. So somewhat difficult they have come up with the reaction and compared to the existing textbooks, no doubt. And the Korea, Japan, China transnational groups and organizations make full use of this volume by doing seminar on this volume and the related issues. Quite useful product again. And the South Korean government, including President Roh Moo-hyun and the so-called 386 generation politicians, younger generation politicians, very much supportive and congratulatory. So quite well received in the political area. One last word, quite positive, but still too early for fuller and, again, nuanced assessment, including China and Japan. We have to see how it works. Okay, that's it.
Thank you. And I'll just get into my part, which is on the Chinese context of this book. Although normally I teach Japan-related subject, I'm wearing a slightly different hat today. I'm also asking myself the three questions I asked of my two co-panelists, namely, what is the process, how this book came about, what is the content in comparison with other history texts in use, and what is the impact? The process, just a brief word about the Chinese members. And there are about 17 members listed at the back of the book. Most of them belong to either the Chinese Social Science Academy, which, as you know, is the government-sponsored research institution, a History Institute, and the Institute of World Economics. Quite a few are affiliated with the universities in China. No history teachers, as in the Korean or the Japanese version. Also, I was told that compared to the Japanese and Korean authors, the Chinese did not have a kind of NGO to tie them together. It's a more loosely organized group. At least one of them, a professor from Shanghai, happened to be the author of a history textbook in use in China. Now, there are currently 7 or 8 different history textbooks in China, sometimes used in a particular locality, sometimes used in a province, some used on a national scale. And this Professor Su Zhiliang of Shanghai Normal University is the author of a relatively liberal history textbook in Shanghai. He also happened to be a Chinese sort of expert on the comfort woman issue. One other lead historian in this group, Bu Ping of the Social Science Academy, he himself is an expert on the biological or chemical weapons issues in World War II. The Chinese team also include one Chinese national teaching in Japan. How did this come about? Both of my co-panelists agree that the process is very important, and I completely agree with that. It took them more than 3 years and over 10 meetings. It's a very intense process. What they did is they first sit down and divide up the whole list of topics. In fact, the Japanese edition has this listed. So they divide the sections to each country almost evenly. And then each country produced a draft. And then they sit down to critique the draft until they reach some kind of consensus. So it's a very, very labor-intensive process. And I think, fortunately, they live really relatively close to each other, so they could fly to another country for a two-day meeting and then come back and then continue to work. They also relied on fax and email. So it's a very, very intense process of interaction. And predictably, even though, as has been mentioned, the Japanese participants are on the left side of the spectrum, they still have a lot of differences among themselves. Sometimes they would continue over a dozen times revision in order to reach a version that is acceptable to all three parties. I was told that there are even some issues that couldn't reach an agreement. And finally, the Chinese authors bring out this card that if we don't reach an agreement, we cannot publish this book. So do you want the book published? Yes. Okay, then let's just settle for the second best. So it is a very, very difficult process. And what is the content? I did not do the same kind of comparison Sun Wan did, but I compare with Chinese history textbooks in general. Here are some of the findings. For one thing, because this book has been almost evenly co-authored by historians and teachers from three countries, what you have is a more or less balanced in terms of the country coverage compared to any Chinese textbooks. So in some ways, the Chinese text also moved away from the typically Sino-centric view of the history that is in use in history textbooks. For example, when they were discussing the language about the First Sino-Japanese War, the Chinese historians have traditionally seen this as simply an example of Japanese aggression against China, and that happened to be fought over Korea. So Korea was very much sidelined in the Chinese historical text. But this time, the Korean historians raised objections that Korea was at the heart of this rivalry between China and Japan. And after several rounds of discussion, the Chinese backed down a little bit and allowed more coverage or inclusion of Korea on this issue. Another general impression is that if you look at the Chinese history text of both Chinese history and world history, which is still pretty much divided into two subjects, the Japanese persons, individuals that appeared, there were about 50 of them, their names, are all men and mostly military officers associated with the aggression and overseas expansion. But if you look at this book, at least we notice in the columns, there were quite a number of women, people from the bottom of society, shall we say. So they really give a very different image of individual Japanese, unlike the typically militaristic Japanese featured in Chinese textbooks. Of course, you know, the same goes with Korean personalities that hardly were mentioned in Chinese textbooks. Sun Wan mentioned the issues of statistics, and as we all know, with regard to the rape of Nanjing, the statistics has achieved, it is sort of taken on life on its own. And rather predictably, again, the Chinese historians and Japanese historians initially disagreed on how to cover the rape of Nanjing, which were initially drafted by Chinese historians. After some discussion, the Chinese historians agreed, in addition to the more or less official statistic of 300,000, Chinese dead. They included the figure 200,000, which was put forward by the Tokyo trial. Now, of course, they said this is brought up by Professor Kazuhara Tokushi of Japan, who is in Japan considered on the left side of the spectrum, especially in the case of Nanjing massacre research. But for Chinese, most Chinese textbooks only mention one number. Only one textbook, the one authored by Su Zhiliang in Shanghai, mentioned the two numbers. So in the press conference after the release of the Chinese edition, the lead Chinese historian Bu Ping went on some lengths to explain why it is necessary to have two numbers. He basically said the historians involved did not disagree over the fundamental nature of the rape of Nanjing. And therefore, quote, as to the issue of numbers, it has to be thoroughly investigated by scholars. Whereas whether to admit there was a massacre or not is a matter of attitude. We didn't have any difference over the attitude, but we should give scholars a chance, plenty of time and conditions to investigate issue of numbers. So you can see here that they're extremely conscious of the sensitive nature of this number issue, and they made some progress opening up this otherwise taboo question in the Chinese context. The third issue I want to say briefly has been mentioned by Sun Wang, that is the victimization of Japanese people themselves. Predictably, for Chinese historians, they were initially rather reluctant to give much coverage to the suffering of Japanese people in the World War II. They made a compromise, however. Instead of having Chinese and Koreans and Japanese suffering grouped together, the Japanese suffering is treated in one separate section, because the Chinese insisted that they're not the same causes for the suffering. If anything, the Chinese and Korean suffering were brought upon by the Japanese, and the Japanese people's suffering were brought upon by their own militarist government. That having been said, if you look at the book, there is rather extensive coverage of Japan's suffering, especially compared to other Chinese texts. I counted in the Chinese version, there is a photo of the Tokyo bombing, the ruins of Tokyo after the Tokyo bombing. There is a picture of the corpses of Okinawans in the Battle of Okinawa, and there is that famous Hiroshima Dome. So in this sense, any Chinese reader would have more exposure to the Japanese suffering. Now, a brief word about the impact. The Chinese, given the size of the population, predictably, again, more copies have been sold. Last time I checked with the publisher, close to 120,000 copies have been sold. And the publisher received several dozen phone calls and letters, and mostly most of them are supportive, although a few pointed out the factual errors in the first printing. Generally, this book has been received quite well in the press and among historians in China, similar to what Sun Wang described in Korea. People's Daily even named it as a noteworthy book in the category of education, books published in 2005. There is a plan to publish a revised edition, and there's also a plan to translate it into Esperanto. I'm sure that will increase the readership tremendously, in addition to the English version. I just want to say a few words about this, how this particular project fit into the general development of joint historical research in East Asia. And I have prepared a very rough chart of some of the ongoing joint historical dialogue in East Asia. I should note that I have been a participant to the first three, and I grouped them in three groups. The first two are essentially conferences on the subject of contentious history, whether it's Sino-Japanese relations or Sino-Japanese war. The first one is particularly contentious. I've witnessed shouting across the conference room between participants. The second one is one example where American and Western historians have initiated and participated in the dialogue. Yet they are still conference-based, and they critique each other's paper at the conference, and then if they're successful, they publish the conference volume, and that's it. The second group are more sustained historical dialogue. The first one, of which I'm a participant, is going to publish a joint publication in Chinese and Japanese this year. However, it differs from this current book we have here because we essentially write our own chapters separately, and then we critique each other over a sustained period of time, and then we publish in two languages. Professor Mochizuki mentioned the problems associated with government-sponsored research. I think it's probably still too early to call because, as I see it, as you see the Japan-Korea joint research, which is sponsored by the government, they have made some important progress. They have a website that put forward their research papers from the first stage, essentially parallel papers, one by Korean scholar, one by a Japanese scholar, on 19 topics. They also created a database and sponsored other joint research. So maybe it is still too early for them to produce a joint book as we have here, but I think the kind of socialization undertaken here is also very important. Japan and China have agreed to undertake similar research last year, but they're still in preparation. The last group is what I call this sort of joint book format. The first one is a rather of a local nature, of a rather limited subject by teachers from one city of Japan and one city of Korea. They have published one joint book last year. And the second one, of course, is the history book that we talk about here. So I just want to inform of the audience here that there are different modes of historical dialogue going on in Asia, and perhaps it is a good thing to have multiple tracks and multiple dialogues. And I think in some ways having one first joint book is indeed a breakthrough, and whatever flaws it has, it at least opened the way and will give future efforts something to ponder over. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. That's very, very interesting. We have about a half hour for discussion. Maybe I just raise one issue. I mean, as an American listening to this, it is curious that America is sort of excised from the history book. And when you list those three topics, three incidents of Japanese victimization, the firebombing of Tokyo, Okinawa, and Hiroshima, it's not incidental. They're all American victimization of Japan. And perhaps that's not so bad for Chinese to accept or others to accept. I wonder if, thinking about the next step in this process, what are they thinking about the next step? Is there consideration for the United States to be involved in any way as a participant, given that the United States is an active participant in this history? I understand the Chinese have been particularly resistant, at least on the textbook side, of including the United States. But how do the other countries feel about that? I just wonder if you know offhand. Maybe there's no answer to that. Okay. Well, anyway, it's a topic to throw out there. Let me, please, yes.
Thank you. Actually, just a brief clarification question. But is it the case that the book, this common book that's been published, is actually identical in all three countries? It's just the preface is different, is that right?
Yeah, the claim of the editors was that they were identical. right? That this was, and that's very much part of the point of the joint project as it's presented. And so I don't think you'll see discrepancy in the choice of photos or things very obvious at first glance. I only have this from just sort of looking around at what newspapers had said. I did see that somebody, a former Mainichi newspaper Seoul chief who seems now to be teaching in Seoul, and where is his name? Sorry. Had found that when he compared the Korean and the Japanese versions, that the description of the North's invasion of, I'm already loading the dice by calling it that, I know why, the description of the origins of the Korean War differed in that the Korean text said that the North attempted a military to unify by force, Buryok Toitsu, or that's the Chinese characters, and that the Japanese version said that the North attempted to liberate the South, he noted that difference. The Sankei newspaper, which was already breathing fire over this whole project, picked that up and also found, I think that interestingly enough, that the, just as a return to the old advancement versus invasion issue, that the Chinese characters used to describe the Western imperial presence in 19th century Asia in the Japanese text had been characters for invasion, and in the Chinese text had been characters for advancement. I haven't confirmed that, and I don't think we should all trust the Sankei newspaper on faith, but that was something that that article also carried.
The issue of translation is critical, but Mike, go ahead.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. The number of copies sold in each of those countries, Professor Park and Professor Yan explained how many copies were sold in Korea and China. How many copies were sold in Japan?
Again, I was looking around for data, and I found a report of 70,000 sold at the end of 2005. Mm-hmm. That was not confirmed, but the suggestion that is plausible was confirmed by a slightly more recent report that the Junkudo bookstore had it on the bestseller list.
I see. And now the question is, why is it that scholars, professors from North Korea and Taiwan did not take part in this project? I know the inherent difficulty, so let me rephrase my question. What kind of effort has been made to get them involved in this project, and why, at the end of the day, the effort failed?
Was there at all?
Well, in an ideal world, yes. I think what happened is, as has been mentioned, it started as a meeting among the like-minded people, right? So if they want to bring the North Koreans and Taiwanese for the inclusion, they're not going to accomplish the like-mindedness.
Perhaps even logistically, would it have been possible to gather Taiwanese and North and South Korean and Chinese and Japanese scholars in one room anywhere in East Asia, just visa-wise?
With the exception of North Koreans, I think the other three are. They haven't been meeting.
I read in the newspaper that this APEN group is thinking about inviting North Korean scholars mm-hmm. for their second project. Whether it will be feasible or not, that's to watch.
We know the next version will say liberation then for certain of South Korea. Yes, ma'am.
Into the path of national division, and the others became just communists, and the other one became that was the Soviet Union, Russia, covered in the book. Soviet Russia.
At least on the table of contents, you don't see any mentioning of Russia or even communism. But in the background of the Korean War, they mention sort of in a matter-of-fact kind of language that the Soviet Union approved the election of People's Committees in the North, whereas in the South, the American authorities did not.
Yeah, I think so. From my observation, U.S. factor is always referred to because of U.S. occupation after the 1945. And as we realized that North Korea is out, I think the Russian issue is related to their control in post-1945 period in North Korea. Then it will come in the eventual long-range picture, I think. This is just the beginning. So first South Korea, and then that's why U.S. it seems like more represented. But Russia is certainly there when we broaden the whole picture of this history dialogue.
If I can just add to that, I mean, I would agree that just looking at the ideological component doesn't come out very much. But the other, in terms of the Russian factor, and this is, I think, a divide between the Tsukudokai textbook and this supplementary material, is that in the Tsukudokai textbook, there is a lot about kind of the Russian geopolitical threat mm-hmm. as a explanation for the Sino-Japanese War and the Russo-Japanese War. And in this supplementary text, the only reference is to Komura's assessment of Russia in the context of the Russo-Japanese War. So that's really played down. So the one motivation for Japan's imperial expansion, the geopolitical one, is really not highlighted that much in this book.
It's not widely used.
Do you have any idea how competitive this book is going to do with
Do you want to speak first?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, also, again, my data might not be the newest, and I think on our list of participants, there were members of the Japanese media. There may be people who have other more concrete information, but. My impression, my understanding was that the Tsukudokai textbook itself had been chosen by very few school districts. It's had an influence in shifting the whole market to the right. And its influence, the influence is not of that textbook alone and its sort of prominence. It's also of prefectural governments passing bills that I believe opposed the use, the discussion of the comfort woman issue in the classroom, for example. So as soon as it appeared, you know, as here, when California goes one direction on an environmental issue, it affects the entire car industry. The same way, as soon as it was clear that some parts of the market were opposed to this, a lot of the other textbook companies started excising the most controversial bits about Nanjing and about the comfort woman issue. So it had an influence of that kind. But my understanding was that it had been adopted in Ehime, maybe, somewhere. And then the Tokyo mayor had, a couple of years ago, tried to have it adopted by a school for the disabled. And perhaps a couple of other districts have picked it up since then. But that its influence is in the general market rather than actually directly in the classroom. That was my impression as of a year or two ago.
On the Chinese side, again, at the press conference, the publisher was asked whether the distribution would be entirely left to the market, and the answer is yes. He said there's not even 炒作, it's like through media, kind of a reporting, try to boost the sale. He said, we don't do that because it's a rather highbrow kind of book. He did mention that, though, he would wish Chinese business would donate money to buy books and then donate these books to schools. At the same press conference, the Korean representative mentioned that the Korean government is very supportive and hoped that through donation from business, they could get more books to the schools in Korea, but that's not happening in China.
I wonder if, I mean, it could be it's too highbrow, or it could be simply the politics of the three societies is not ready for this. And I wonder if you all can speak to the sort of the politics of history now in the countries. Are the societies ready for this? I mean, 70,000 is good, but there may be constituencies in each country, you know, a minority, who find this very appealing, but because of peer pressure, because of political pressures, both government and non-government, there's a sense that they're, you know, the societies may not be ready for the truth, the full truth, or a considered, coordinated truth among the three countries. I wonder if you can speak, maybe each of you, to the domestic environments in which this is being introduced now, and do you think majorities or increasing majorities are ready for this to be taught?
Well, you know, I mean, I think what I was talking about, this discussion we've been having about the tsukurukai in general is the answer. The public opinion in Japan right now is extremely divided. It probably always was on the memory of the war, but now that's being fought and fought quite virulently out in the marketplace, in the bookshops and so forth, and the tsukurukai have really, really changed the sort of terrain of debate by being so open in their nationalism and calling upon in a manner that I think is very seductive to particularly to a younger generation far from the war and from the post-war, calling upon Japanese to, you know, to feel, to stand up and feel proud and not be you know, apologizing to anybody anymore. That's a very seductive line. And it's in that context that this is thrown out there. Of course, there's a hardworking academic left, you know. But ready, what would ready mean? You know, it mean that everybody agrees?
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of, I mean, even in the States and anywhere, the loud voice, you know, who's hard line can appeal to a certain segment and can seem, can be more marketable. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily the majority, or if another section or segment of society is tapped, perhaps that can gain some momentum, but they're more silent, not as, they're more moderate, so they're not as loud. I just wonder if I mean, that's the question we all have, is what is the prevailing, you know, view in Japan? Some people say it's becoming very nationalistic. Yeah. And others say it's just not there. Yeah. You know, it's being overstated. I'm not sure there's an easy answer to come to.
No. But I'll say one more thing about that, I think, of a slightly more positive nature about nationalism in Japan right now, and this is related to the education issue. I don't know whether it's already been passed, but there's been a contentious political battle over the revision of the basic law of education in Japan. The basic law of education was put in place in 1948, so under an American occupation. And one of the key elements of the revised law that the Liberal Democratic Party wants to see put in place is an explicit desideratum that education should inspire love of country. That's not in the basic education law of 1948. It might not surprise you to hear that had a much more sort of internationalist ring to it, and they're trying to change that. That's one thing going on. Well, there's been very, very strong resistance, even to the level of sensitivity, you know, in the political world, and it's not just on the left, even to an overt expression that that kind of nationalism or patriotism should be a goal of education. And it comes, for example, from the Clean Government Party, the Komeito, which is part of the conservative alliance. And it's because anything that suggests a return to the ultranationalism or the sort of language of nation of pre-1945 in the classroom still is extremely thorny. And I think that's quite a gauge. And yet there, simultaneously, we have this kind of Kobayashi Yoshinori's style of populist nationalism in the marketplace. So on the one hand, within government, I think there's still a great deal of caution.
Well, to answer your question whether the society's ready, I think that's very hard to gauge, but at least from the reception of this book in China so far, it seems safe to say that among educators and historians, they are ready to move to a slightly more balanced, I mean, this is a very relative term, obviously, mm-hmm. but compared to what they have now, to move in the direction of a slightly more balanced treatment of war and the East Asian history. Beyond that, it's really hard to speculate what the general public is saying, because the market is so saturated with books about atrocities, aggression, and atrocities, aggression, whereas this one does provide an alternative.
Just, I have to run. I apologize very much. I'll let Dr. Park speak on this issue, and then I'll turn to Mike, but thank you all very much.
Okay, so probably I have much more to say than Japan or China, because of this very dynamic democratization movement going on in South Korean society. And in terms of a history issue, from early 1990s on, Korean both political leadership and civil society very deeply involved in these internal historical injustice issues, not just interstate, this external one. And throughout the decade, and especially after Kim Dae-jung's coming into power in 1998, it picked up more momentum. And until last year, 2005, it went very well, positively, and there is a general consensus that these history issues, both external and internal history issues, that they have to overcome to have some healing of the past wounds and also move forward for the more mature democratic society. So there is a consensus, and then started handling this Gwangju incident and also previously the post-1945 civilian massacre, like Jeju, April 3rd, the Jeju incident. Every post-1945 historical injustices, the individual human rights violated by the authoritarian state was talked about, debated, even in the National Assembly level. So it's been going on quite positively, and Kim Dae-jung, so political leadership is very important in this whole history dialogue. And I'm not pro Kim Dae-jung or anything, but his so-called de-linking, these diplomatic issues and history issues worked quite well until recently, the Tokto incident emerging in the spring of 2005. And then Nomuyan government changed the Kim Dae-jung's this delinking policy on history issues to relinking. So let's talk about history issues in the Koizumi and Nomuyan talk, kind of more hardline and in a sense more nationalistic policy changes. So it's a thing to watch and see whether it was a good turning point or a negative one. It's in that sense, I think both, this is very important to overcome these history issues, internal historical redress, which is lacking when I watch these three countries in Japan or China. There are things that they have to deal with sometime in the hopefully near future or in the future. Otherwise, this will go on and on. And in that sense, there are a lot to offer from South Korean experience, how to improve the relations with the former aggressor or former historical enemy. So in terms of political environment, I think timing was very good for South Korea. This simultaneity of democratizing energy with these both internal and history issues throughout the 1990s worked very well and dynamically going on. Then you might ask, what's this sign of very nationalistic demonstration and protest against something like Tokto issue, Takeshima Island issue? It looks like very politicized and nationalized. But I have to report that civil society in South Korea is very wide spectrum now. It's very diverse groups, full of dynamism, and also there's a division line between generational division in the country, younger generation, quite internet equipped, and they can be very dynamic but also very violent in some way. So, and the media, again, there are they play two-edged sword. Sometimes they used that nationalistic sentiment and sensationalized it. So please be aware of this crisscross of these two forces, short range, rather politicized and seemingly nationalistic reaction. But overall, I am quite positive. There is a long range and more balanced and more mature understanding about this history issue. And one good example of this Nomuyan government's handling of this history issue was forced labor issue. Last January 2005, for the first time after 60 years, I'm sorry, 40 years after 1965, they declassified the whole document on Japan-Korea normalization talk, huge volume. And, of course, previously they evaluated all the issues, and forced labor and compensation issue was one of the main issue. And now it's widely open. And they came out with a much more precise policy on forced labor. For example, they, in two ways, last August 15, Nomuyan government announced this as a formal policy. In the interstate level, they will ask Japan to join this in other words, truth-finding and apology and compensation and reconciliation, that scheme. And then secondly, South Korea, for the first time, admit that the compensation by Park Chung-hee government was not enough, really way shamefully spotty. So they picked up that issue and they took the responsibility. We will first have the truth-finding, fact-finding, and then we'll take a responsibility of a compensation, which is quite a breakthrough in a sense. So political leadership in South Korea is very deeply involved in this history issue, not just the interstate, but internal history issue too. So lots of compensation these days. For example, one SNU professor, Choi Jong-gil was his name, was taken to KCIA during the Park Chung-hee period, and he was one of these suspicious death case. So after 10 years of this real fact-finding and evaluation, both government and the judicial body decided to compensate his death to his surviving family members. So that's just tip of iceberg. So much internal history redress going on in South Korea. Okay, so I worked with Ta Ching for several years. I found this is quite unique and also, in a sense, a fortunate case. The timing was quite fortunate for Koreans dealing with their past, not just World War II, but post-1945 period. Okay?
Okay, we have time for one more question, and then I'll give the floor to Neil Silver.
This is more of an observation as I listen to this, and it's not a perfect analogy or metaphor. Like the Civil War studies in the United States, I think this is going to go on and on. When I listen to the Skurukai people, it sounds something like the ladies in Richmond, Virginia in about 1900 trying to create that beautiful boulevard of monuments to the heroes of the Civil War. When I listen to this manga, find out about this manga fellow, it reminds me of kind of Birth of the Nation. So this project that's been held is certainly very worthy, but it's the metaphor to me is kind of a conference of historians and high school teachers of the North and the South in about 1905, trying to figure out what actually happened in the Civil War. Again, to continue this perhaps sad metaphor, you know, if you go into a Chinese bookstore, it's like going into Borders bookstores in the United States and seeing all the books we have on the Civil War, just in China alone, on Civil War studies, on this anti-Japanese struggle period and the post-war period, there's enormous number of books, some of which are actually quite creative, and there's a lot of different strains of thought and a lot of contention among them, which is very rarely gets, you know, into the international media. Just to wrap this up, two kind of modest proposals. One is, I wonder whether, if some NGO is really interested in fostering this history, whether picking out 5 or 10 titles a year produced in any one of these countries and translating them into another language might be helpful. For instance, I'm not aware of the book by the Asahi Shimbun fellow Tanaka on the Nanjing Massacre, which has been translated into English. I'm not aware whether it's ever been translated into Chinese, and I think it would have a major impact on the way Chinese look at Japanese if they knew such a book existed. Similarly, there's some books now being written in China on the Korean War, the origins of the Korean War, which I think if translated into other languages, particularly English, would have a major impact on people. And again, just to finally sum this up, I wonder whether a journal, since this is obviously going to go on for another 100 years at least, and I bet in the year 2200, in all the Borders-like bookstores in China, there will be vast shelves on this period. Problems of communism, a kind of middle-brow journal of problems of World War II and post-World War II. I'm not sure they all call it World War II, but whatever they call it out there. So the problems of this history that was published in several languages, I think, might be a very good forum for a lot of new ideas and just to sort of show people around the whole region that there are a lot of different ways of looking at it. I mean, the way we look at the Civil War in the United States in 2006 is a heck of a lot different than the way we looked at it in 1906. So just to end that metaphor.
Okay, very quick.
Very quick question. Maybe a bit esoteric. In the history books that exist and the history book that you're discussing, is there any discussion of maybe the people, not just people who, the atrocities or bad things that happened or bad people, but people who were people of conscience, people who were resistors? And I'm particularly talking about Sugihara, the Japanese foreign ministry official who signed all the visas in Lithuania and saved so many thousands of people. Is there any mention in the current books in Japan and in this book itself where there are examples of heroes?
Well, just quickly to answer that, in some of the textbooks that have been approved by the Japanese textbook committee, there are there is mention of Sugihara.
He's a favorite.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is so. But in this particular book, I didn't read this close enough. I didn't
yeah,
see
there's
su-
one.
Okay, no, Sugihara, but there. If you just look at the table of contents, which we have, there are so-called anti-war Japanese soldiers.
That's right.
Japanese soldier who fessed up the crimes. So there are supposedly good Japanese.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we've come to the end of our time. I want to again thank the CSIS and Derek and also Ms. Kazuo Kato for making all the arrangements for this program, the panelists, and of course, all of you who came and attended and asked terrific questions. Thank you very much.